everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. Today's show is an extended interview with Siamak, a member in Iran who got clean there when there was only one group in the country. This is the second in our series of shows about the unprecedented growth that happened in the NA fellowship there. Our last show included interviews with a few members from around the world who had visited there and shared with us what things are like there now. So we were very excited to be speaking this time to a member who was involved in that growth. Our central question was, how did that happen? What did you guys do? Surely there was a magic bullet of some kind, a perfect storm of factors. We were determined to get to the bottom of it, and you'll hear that in the line of questioning. When Pete and Daniel, the two World Board members who first visited Iran, met Siamak, he was clearly in a key role there. They described him as having that mix of humility, willingness to serve however asked, and an action-oriented ability to organize and provide leadership. Upon their return, NA World Services decided, for a variety of reasons, that there should be a branch office of the WSO in Iran, and Siamak was hired as its manager. He still serves in that capacity now, even though he has moved with his family to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, where we caught up with him for this interview via video teleconference.
Siamak, how had you heard about Narcotics Anonymous? How did you end up at your first meeting?
When I was trying to kick my habit, there was no rehab centers, nothing in Iran. So I only had two alternatives. One was to get arrested by the police because it was a crime to be an addict. You know, it wasn't a disease. You were a criminal if you were using. So either I had to go to jail, or there was this place which was owned by the government, and it was inside the jail. But if you go there voluntarily and introduce yourself and pay them some money, they would just take you into the jail, but it was a different situation. I mean, the food was better. They would give a bed. They wouldn't shave your head. You know, in prison, it was like, I don't know, 200 people had to sleep in a small room, so you had no place. No, it was a disaster. So I went to one of these places, and I wanted to join voluntarily. But they didn't accept me. They told me that I'm over 30 years old and I got so many records. You know, I've been, they have taken me in so many times to kick my habit, but I went out and used it again. So they have no hope, and I'm over 30 years old. So they didn't accept me. They didn't take me in. So I was leaving the place, and just by, you know, coincidence, I met a friend which I used to use with him. But he looked nice and clean and everything. And he asked me what's my deal. So I told him. And he said, oh, come back, I'll help you. So he took me back to the place again. And later I realized that he's been in NA for about 8 or 9 months. It was 8 or 9 months clean. And then it was even the number of the NA members were less than 30, 35. So he talked to the guys. And they knew he's clean. They knew some NA members, and they knew these guys are staying clean on their own, and you know they're really lucky. So he talked to the officials there, and they, because of him, they accepted to take me in. So they took me in, and I went there. And while I was there for a month. A couple of times, a few NA members would come there and try to carry the message, and this friend of mine came in too. And so the day I left, I went to the meeting the next day. That he gave me the address of the meeting, and he told me I should call him. So I went there, and that's, you know, how I got to know.
So as small as they were doing essentially H&I work.
Yes, without knowing it. They didn't even know what it is called. They were just looking for addicts to bring in.
What year was that?
Well, it was 1998. So I've been in NA a little less than 18 years, and then we only had one group in all Iran, in Tehran.
Is that right?
Yeah, and it was like maybe 40, 45 members, but we were all very together. I mean, we all knew each other very well. Everyone, you know, care of each other. I mean, if one day one of us didn't show up to a meeting, the next day everyone would either call him or go to his house, see what's happening with him. And, you know, we never left each other alone. So, and we usually spend our time together too. I mean, the day, I mean, we had three weekly meetings, this group had on Mondays, Saturdays, Mondays, and Wednesdays. And like any day that we had a meeting, there was a small park right beside the meeting place. So we would gather around there like 2 hours before the meeting starts. And we just sat there and talked to each other and drink tea and then go to the meeting. And then after the meeting, they still spend some more time. I mean, I remember that for the first at least year, I was never alone. Always, I mean, even the days that we didn't have any meeting, it was like three or four members. We would go out, I don't know, lunch. We didn't have much money, so just walk in the parks and things like that. You know? But, we were all together. I mean, the unity was very, very good. And we used to receive newcomers. Not much, but they would come and stay. I mean, most of the people I remember that came in as a newcomer, they stayed.
At this point, I suggested we jump to a description of NA in Iran now, then come back and talk through how we got there from one group meeting three times a week and a trickle of newcomers.
Now we have over 3,600 groups, which is about over 18,000 weekly meetings all over Iran. The members, I can't tell you an exact figure, but I'm thinking about maybe 350,000 to 400,000. I mean, by the way, we saw the literature and key tags and medallions every month. So I'm guessing about 350,000.
Let's let that one sink in for just a moment. As we record this interview, it's estimated that there are just over 60,000 NA meetings in the world. Siamak just told us that in Iran, there are about 18,000 weekly meetings, and we have heard other estimates of about 20,000. So 30%, nearly one of every three NA meetings in the world, is in Iran. And as we've heard in these interviews, relatively small meetings there have maybe 100 to 300 members in attendance. Large meetings, maybe 8 to 1,200 or more. And all other statistics bear these numbers out. Sales of key tags and literature and attendance at events, for example. As you'll see, I keep trying in these interviews to understand just what factors came together to result in this mind-boggling growth. I'll break in here and there as some of them began to emerge in the discussion.
So what happened? How did it go from one group meeting three times a week to what it is now? What was the first kind of thing that happened?
Well, what I heard was that, you know, this one guy who was my sponsor for a while tried to contact these guys in the, we have an organization which is called the, I don't know, welfare organization, which is owned by the government. They deal with addicts. So he went there and he tried to talk with them and get a meeting space and try to go to places where they deal with addicts. So he secured this one place and he started a meeting of his own and he was alone. And he said he's been sitting there for, I don't know, I mean, he used to go to these like jail-like places and carry the message and try to talk to addicts in the street or anything. So he says it took at least nearly a year before the first newcomer walks in, which he walked in and he stayed in NA, and he's the one who's got over 20 years clean now. He's the first addict who became clean in Iran. He's still in Iran and he's still clean. He's not involved in service or anything, but it's clean and it goes to meetings all the time.
How familiar is that story? The earliest members in most places tell of sitting alone, holding the space, maybe reading literature if there was literature at the time, and waiting for that first addict to show up. Without that service, no one gets to have this. It was starting to dawn on me that maybe I was looking for some unfamiliar silver bullet, but so far, the Iran experience looks pretty normal.
When you came in, literature had not yet been translated. Yes.
We had a textbook which was translated, but it had some mistakes in it, in the translation. we had a couple of IPs translated. You know, it was translated by this guy from USA, which I told you he was my sponsor for, right? But it was an edited, not the textbook, not the IPs. None of them looked like what you see today. I mean, it was like on an A4 piece of paper, you know, just copied or handwritten, you know, a lot of mistakes. So that was about it. And we didn't have enough of them. So we had this guy who was a literature man, and he had like 3 copies of textbook or some copies of the IPs. So he would lend it to me, for instance, for 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, I had to return it to him so he can lend it to another member. So, you know. Then after we started our structure, we formed a translation committee. The first thing we did was trying to revise the textbook and to get it approved by the World Service. So that's how I started. And another guy who joined us, he used to live in Canada for a long time. His English was very good. He was a good translator. He translated his works on Hawaii, but later on went out and sold it to the government and sold the copyright to the government as the translator. So we, once we started our structure, one of the things we did as a PI was that we went out and tried to convince the government to return us the copyright of the book because it's ours and they cannot use it. I mean, they cannot sell it in the streets because no one's going to use it. So thank God they agreed and they returned the copyright to us. But then he went out a few years ago. He went out in USA and tried to sue Nas for the book, and we retranslated it. But his was good too, but we had problems with it.
Wow.
That was the second book translated.
So in terms of a turning point or something must have happened kind of suddenly and rapidly for it to grow to the level that it grew. Can you identify that? Like what happened?
Well, I think one thing was that what we did was we had this one guy who came from USA and a few other guys joining him, and they used to go to different cities in Iran, all over Iran, and try to carry the message there and find addicts who were willing to become clean. And then this welfare organization, any addict anywhere in Iran would go there and try to kick their habit. They would talk to them and try to send them to Tehran so we can tell them how to start a meeting. So we did that for two, three years.
So PR, find out what agencies or organizations are trying to help addicts and make sure they know about us. Figure out how to best work with them to get addicts introduced to NA. Still sounding pretty normal.
NA started to have meetings in different cities, but we were not connected. I mean, one day we would hear, oh, okay, there's a meeting starting in Isfahan, or the next day we would hear there's another meeting in Shiraz, you know, which are 1,000 kilometers away from Tehran. And I don't know, in north of Iran, in south of Iran, but it was like a small groups. So once we started our structure, it was only, for a while, it was only in Tehran. Then when we started our services structure, we had maybe 4 or 5 NA meetings in Tehran. So we were gathering once a month and trying to have a service meeting. Then we decided that we should try to join these guys in.
So outreach, or what's often called fellowship development these days. Because of the early PR efforts, addicts get released to smaller communities and start NA there, but they're isolated. So we start a broader service structure to include them and get them involved. Another one of the fundamentals of NA's approach to service.
Forming the services structure and translation of the literature, because before the literature was translated, we didn't really know what to do. I mean, anything we do, it was like reinventing the field. You know, we were just doing it. Sometimes we did a good job, sometimes we made a mess, you know. But we didn't have anything to go on. So one of the first books that I translated as the LTC chair myself was the local service manual. And once we translated that, then the structure just started to form. And before that, we didn't know what is the area, what does GSR really have to do, you know, how can we connect? And I mean, we were doing PI, but we didn't know what we did. We did have some form of HNI, but, you know, we didn't know the right way to do it, or translation, or, you know. So once we translated this local service, it made a big difference.
He used the term LTC chair, Literature Translations Committee. Nearly anywhere outside the U.S., including English-speaking countries where there are active fellowship development efforts involving non-English-speaking fellowships, this is a familiar term and a well-developed part of any service structure, much like H&I or PR. NA World Services, or NAS, employs full-time staff to coordinate with these committees. There is a specific order in which things are translated into any language, because certain pieces, such as who, what, how, and why, contain much of the terminology needed to build a recovery glossary in that language and provide the basics needed to hold meetings. They then progress through a few other pieces until the community has the basics needed to decide what's next and prioritize. NAS often contracts with professionals to work with the locals at the appropriate level for each community. Developing this process and gaining this experience was a bumpy road, but it is now a mature process, though mostly outside the view of the U.S. Fellowship. It is resource-intensive for NAS and a lot of hard work for the local community, but it is obviously critical for the continued spread and growth of NA. As this is being recorded, there are meetings in 77 languages in 131 countries.
Yeah, so that essentially brought you together with a kind of a game plan or a something to look at to say, here's kind of what we should be doing in terms of services and sort of how, and then you guys brought your own creativity to that and it started to grow.
Yes, yes. And also that translations. I mean, once we translated the books and we started to print them in numbers, then we could send some to different cities, you know, some to Shiraz, some to Isfahan, some to North of Iran, some to South of Iran. And when they had the literature, then, you know, they could start growing too.
Literature. In their case, it was translations. In the U.S., it was original literature development. But the result was the same. Once addicts and NA communities have literature that lays out the basics of our recovery program and the approach to service, we grow. Still, no magic bullet, just a focused approach to the fundamentals of service.
So if I get you right, it's one group with a few meetings in Tehran, and then it's a few...
Then a few others started in Tehran, you know, like different parts of Tehran.
Okay.
I mean, first in Tehran, we became like, after a while, maybe after a year or so, we had maybe 10, 12 groups. Then it started to have meetings in different cities too.
All right, and then it seems to me from talking to you before and from looking at it that you guys must have gotten serious about public information, public relations at some point. And did you begin to do some outreach to the government, to the religious leaders, or how did that relationship get going?
Well, in Iran, you cannot just go and open up a meeting. I mean, any place you want to rent, you have to talk to the officials. So, and usually the officials are somehow connected to the government, and the government is connected to the clergy. And so we reach out to them, because we realize that without them, it's very hard to have our meetings going, and it's very hard to grow. So we have to have them, some kind of green light. I mean, like a lot of our meetings are in mosques. And obviously, a mosque is run by a clergyman. And so we had to talk to them. Some of them liked us very much. So that we reached out to them, and we still do. And then after a while, I mean, for translations, we had problems with them because they called us in. Some of the points we have in our steps, they didn't like. Like they said, you know, you're not supposed to understand your own God. You know, we tell you who God is, you know. So we have to explain to them why we say that. And they didn't like our fifth step. They said it's a Christian thing, you know. So we had to explain to them why we're doing it. Of course, they were cooperative. I mean, so far, they haven't made us a big trouble. But we reached out to them, because it's kind of impossible to survive in Iran without having some kind of support.
Let me ask you on that point. Did you have to change the wording at any point of the steps or the traditions in order to make it more palatable to the clergy?
No. God as we understand him, we exactly translated the same words. It's exactly the same in Farsi. Fifth step is exactly the same wording that you're using in English. So no, but we had to explain to them why. Otherwise, we had suggestions from them that, okay, then maybe it's a better idea if we make Islamic version of NA. But we explained to them that it's not going to work. And plus that we have Christians in Iran, we have Jews in Iran, and they're addicts. And once they're an addict, then there is no difference. So, they went along with that. I mean, they had the issues with it, but they went along.
One thing I'm interested in is, I mean, we're always trying to understand what can we learn from the Iranians that, it's a hard thing to translate across. You might've heard in that interview that I did with Pete, I was saying it had to be a perfect storm of A, B, C, and D, a perfect storm of the nature of addiction and the type of drugs, the aspects of the culture, something about the spirituality, the degree of addiction. What would you say that list is? It's a perfect storm of what factors that caused the NA in Iran to blow up the way that it did.
Well, first of all, I think it can be culturally because we are, spiritual people. I mean, we could embrace the concepts of the steps pretty easily, because we just already have these kind of ideas ourselves. It might be different to Islam, but spirituality is not religious, So all Iranian spiritual programs and all Iranian spiritual beliefs made it easy for us to embrace the principle of the program and the 12 steps. That's one of the reasons. The other reason is that, I don't know how, but our members are very serious about the program. Once they're in and they get they get a grip on the program and they understand what it is about, they're really serious about it. I mean, about their recovery and about service, both. Becomes their whole life. Even some army, I know so many members that NA has gone inside their family. I mean, when you talk to the kid, I mean, he's got a 10-year-old kid. And when you talk to the kid, he knows NA very well. And he talks about the steps and or their wives or things like that. So they take it into their houses. They don't try to divide it from their family life. So word of mouth. And we have this thing in Iran, like when we used to use drugs, it was like gangs in the different neighborhoods, like 20 guys, 25, 30, from the same neighborhood, they would all use at the same time, they would use in the same place, and they were all in contact. So once one of them becomes clean and come to NA and find a way out, he would go out to that 20 people and try to bring him in, And it usually works, because the rest of the guys would follow. So now you can even see that the NA is like that in Tehran. I mean, each different neighborhood you go, you see certain members supporting that very group in their own neighborhood. So that was another thing which I think is cultural. And the third reason is, for an addict in Iran, once you come clean, there is not much to do. You don't have much hobbies there. So maybe a lot of them just spend that time in the NA meeting because there's nothing better to do. But they just become accustomed to it and follow it up, because in Iran they cannot. I mean, there's not as much sports as you have in USA. There is not much discotheques as you have in USA. There is no places to hang out, So they hang out in NA meetings. And, we go to an NA meeting, it's like, it starts 2 hours before the real meeting starts and ends 2 hours after the meeting is finished. I mean, like, these guys spend 6 or 7 hours going to a meeting. You know, they just hang around. It's usually held in parks and or mosques, which are inside a park or places like that. So they come out after the meeting and they just hang around there for hours and, you know, sit there and drink tea and talk. And it's a way to spend time too.
It became a little subculture that
yes.
was very attractive. And there must have been something about the suffering too, about the degree to which the addicts there were ready for something to work.
Oh, definitely, yes. Yes, because in Iran, well, before we did, you know, as I told you, we didn't even have rehab centers. Addicts, they had to do or die. That's it. I mean, they had to either keep taking drugs, or if they wanted to kick, they had no options. They had to go cold turkey with no medications, and then they didn't know how to stay clean, and no therapy, no shrinks, no nothing, you know. Or if it, I mean, we did have shrinks, but not that many of them, and they were expensive. No one could afford them, and no one believed in them, you know. So, I mean, once NA came, they thought, okay, that's it. I mean, they saw people going there, staying clean, getting clean, and staying clean. It was hope for them, so we attracted a lot of people. And a lot of families convinced their husbands or their sons to go to meetings. I mean, we get a lot of members through word of mouth, you know.
See, Matt, as you know, in America, there are a number of approaches to addiction, and one of them that's even seems to be increasing somewhat at the urging of the government are medication-assisted therapies, medication-assisted treatment. Does that exist in Iran?
Nowadays, yes, a bit. We have, I think they have Suboxone, I think they have Methadone. It's not as big, you know. So we have a lot of what we call camps in Iran now, which was, this one was actually started by an NA member in Iran, separate from NA, it's not NA, but it was founded by an NA member, which they go to parks or jungles outside the city, and they start up these camps and tents, and they start taking in the addicts for a month and help them get clean. Of course, they don't have much medication. Most of them, you have to go through cold turkey and then any meetings, that's it.
Those camps that you were talking about, you heard the interview with Pete where I was asking him about that because he visited one. He said maybe a few hundred people at the camp. Is that typical or would they be larger than that? Or?
No, a few hundred is big. I mean, as big as it gets. But we have a lot of them.
Okay.
They look at it, you know, they don't have the facility. I mean, they have to have the water, I don't know, toilets, things like that, which makes it hard inside the park.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that addiction, when you came in, was a crime in Iran.
Yeah, yes.
Is it still a crime to be an addict?
Well, the law is still a crime, yes. But the officials don't believe in it. They don't, they're not, I mean, now they don't just imprison you because you're an addict. Before they used to. But the law still says that you're a criminal if you're an addict. So if they want to pick on it, they can do it. But it's been a long time that they haven't. And I think one of the big reasons who changed their mind was NA. It was the PI in NA, and it was us who went there and tried to explain to them that this is a disease. First of all, the professionals, the doctors, and everyone, they changed their mind and they accepted it as a disease. And after that, it kind of got into the officials.
Is this a unique relationship, that what you've described, between Narcotics Anonymous and the government and ultimately the clergy?
Yeah, well, we'd try to have relationships with any kind of organization there is in Iran. I mean, it goes as far as universities, it goes as far as the clergy, even our intelligence services, our police departments, prisons, and anybody that we can get our hands on that they have a dealing with addicts, or they can secure us a meeting space, because you know the numbers are so big that we always are in need of more places to hold our meetings in.
When I looked at the list of non-governmental organizations within the United Nations, Narcotics Anonymous is a recognized NGO. Narcotics Anonymous Iran has its own recognition.
Yeah.
What was the reason for that?
you know, Iran doesn't recognize international NGOs to have branches or whatever inside the country, so they have to be independent. We had to elect a board of directors and, you know, introduce them to the government. And yeah, it was a long process. It took us several years. You know, they wouldn't want to do it. For the first 5 or 6 years, they wouldn't do it. I mean, I remember the first business meeting I ever attended in NA, which is about 18 years ago, was a meeting that they were talking about gaining a legal status for NA. And I didn't understand what they're talking about. You know, I was only maybe a week or 2 weeks clean then. And it carried on until I was, I don't know, maybe 14 or 15 years clean. So it was a very long process, and we had to get okay from a lot of different government officials, clergy. It was very hard. You know? And now we have to renew it every couple of years. So we have to establish and maintain those relationships in order to have our legal status.
You know, when I hear you describe that, and when I heard you, when you answered earlier when I asked, you know, about your early PR efforts, and you were basically saying we didn't have any choice. If we wanted to have meetings, we had to go create these relationships. It kind of strikes me that that might be part of the success in the end. One of the hidden jewels was that you had to develop the discipline of PI/PR and learn how to create those relationships right from the beginning. Whereas in the States, it usually goes H&I first and then eventually PR, but that's a more sophisticated kind of service, a little bit harder to get your head around. But if you have to do it right from the gate, it later became an asset that your fellowship had, was those relationships and that skill at creating and maintaining it.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. I mean, we had to do, I mean, as you said, the addicts in Iran suffered so much and there was no options for them. And once they found an A, then they were willing to do anything for it to go on. Mm. And they saw a window of opportunity. We have to do something to keep our meetings going on. And we have to do something to get more addicts and things like that. So that they just come by instinct, you know. I mean, we didn't, as I said, we didn't know what is PI, we didn't know what is HNI, but by instinct, we knew that we have to survive.
Yeah.
And this is the only chance. I mean, I was an addict. I mean, at least I was using heroin for 21 years myself. So after 21 years and been to so many different doctors and shrinks and rehabs and here, I mean, I became addict in England. I kicked my habit in USA several times, and I knew there is no chance for me. So once I found an A in Iran, I thought, okay, you know. So we knew that we have to somehow try to survive, and no one's going to help us, not the officials, not the people, not our family, but ourselves.
Yeah, so NA was just a perfect fit in your culture for all of the conditions that existed. So, and it starts to blossom. And I, you know, I was trying to see if you could identify a turning point, a thing, and you really were kind of saying there really wasn't a single turning point, right? It was a time where all of this started coming together. Groups started forming in Tehran. Groups started forming in other cities. Then a service structure started to form. You translated the guide to local service. There were certain things like the underlying spirituality of the culture was a good fit for the principles of NA. The level of desperation and really the lack of other things going on in the lives of these addicts when they really made a full functioning subculture of NA fairly quickly. And then it really takes off. So as it really took off, which included some of these, we were talking about sort of these detox camps that you just described, and all these things are going on where now you're getting an influx of newcomers, that it must have been just a flood of newcomers for some number of years. Can you talk about that a little bit and how that impacted the sponsorship techniques that you guys had developed and adopted that we've heard about, and describe some of that?
Yeah, well, nothing happened, you know, just by one click or just overnight. As you said, it was a process, you know, and everything came together for us to grow. For a while, after we started growing, the number of the newcomers we were getting was a lot. I mean, it was just substantial. We could, any meeting you would go, you would see 30, 35, sometimes even more newcomers, you know, picking up their white tags. Right now, we still get newcomers, but maybe not as much because, I don't know, I think it's mostly because of the industrial drugs. Now, hardly anyone takes heroin or opium in Iran. It's like crack, yeah, and things like that. So these guys are a little harder to deal with, or to, when they come to an end, they are a little, I mean, as long as their head is all mixed up, it's a little harder for them to embrace the principle. So I'm still be getting a lot of newcomers, but I mean, for a while, for 4 or 5 years, I mean, it was just unbelievable.
How did that impact sponsorship?
Well, the sponsorship from the first day in Iran was kind of funny. It's, again, not funny, but funny for Americans that are used to work one person to one person, face to face. From the very first day, I knew a sponsorship was in the group. Because even, like, as I told you, when I came to NA, it was like 45 of us. But out of these 45, none of us have worked the steps. The only experience we had with the steps was reading it in the book. So when this guy came from USA, came back from USA, the one who was one of the founders, he wanted to, I mean, we asked him to work the steps with us, and he said, okay, but we couldn't do it face-to-face with 45 people at the same time, you know. So we had to start groups, so he divided it into three groups, like 15 members in each group, and he would do it like Saturday morning with this group, Sunday morning with the other one, Monday evening with the other one, you know, every week. So that's how we learned sponsorship from the very first day, to do it in the groups. And then, of course, I did have sponsees myself that I worked face-to-face with them, but that was like my first or second sponsee. After that, I couldn't, because the numbers started growing so much that I couldn't do it face-to-face. I just didn't have enough time or enough energy. So I had to do it. It's the common thing to do. Everyone's doing it.
So the way that works, then does the sponsor give talks, give sort of a, is it kind of a lecture format? Does everybody share in these groups, or how does that work?
Well, I can tell you my own experience. What I do is, in order to be some kind of to have some kind of organization, I use the Step Working Guide. So we read parts of the book, and we talk about it. If anyone has any experience, they say they share their experience. If they have any questions, they would ask me as a sponsor, or I sometimes get other people to answer the questions if they have. Then we get to questions. Once we get to the questions, I tell them, okay, you go home, you answer these questions, and you come back next week and we read it. So what happens, they go home and like there's 10 questions or 5 questions or whatever. They write about it, they have a week, and they come back next week and they start, I mean, one by one, they start reading their answers. And once we get to step 4 out of 5, and I mean 5, when they want to read their inventory, what I personally do is that I'll tell them, okay, if you leave this in this group and you think they're not going to break your anonymity, just share your inventory in the group. But if you don't, you don't have to. So read the parts that you can and leave the rest for me. So with what we do, they read whatever inventory they are willing to read in the group, and the parts that they are not willing to do, they will hold on to it. And then for a while, I have to make it face-to-face. You know, I would make like 1 hour for him, 1 hour for the other one, you know, in several different days. So they come and read the parts that they just want me to listen. And once we pass step 5, then we start the step 6.
You know, my experience with that, with doing that on retreats or doing that in a group, is that the is that there's something extra powerful and liberating when you do share your inventory stuff in a group.
Yes, exactly. I experienced it too. I mean, once I say it in a group, it's just gone. I mean, any kind of resentment, any kind of fear, when I said it in a group, it's just, I'm okay. I mean, I've done it with my sponsor alone too. That works too. But when I said it in a group, it's just a different feeling. It's just like, yeah, I'm free. It's gone. You know?
It's like so many other things in recovery. It takes a special amount of, a special kind of courage. But when you exercise that special kind of courage, you get a special kind of freedom.
Yeah, and the bond that is created between that group, it's just amazing. I mean, they would never. I mean, they'd be brothers for the rest of their life. What from what I see, I mean, the sponsors I had that they worked the steps in the same group, they're real close to friends. And when I'm not in Iran, they just use each other as a sponsor.
You know, there's a phenomenon that you see sometimes in the States with certain sponsors who will hold a retreat with their sponsees and do some of those kinds of things where you have a level of self-disclosure and a fifth step level of sharing and stuff that goes on in a group. And people come away from there sharing both how scary that was, the idea of sharing that stuff in a group, and just how deep the bonds were and how great the liberation was. So, you know what, it strikes me one more time, here's something where it was necessity that it really required, the sheer numbers of newcomers you were dealing with almost required that you do this sort of group type sponsorship, but you stumbled again on a jewel, on something that turned out to be quite a powerful thing for everybody involved.
Yeah, it's, you know, and now, I mean, it's still the sponsors have to do it, because for a sponsor to have over 20 sponsors in Iran is normal. 20 is nothing. You know? I mean, we have people with 50, 60, 80, 100 sponsors. I myself, I don't even know how many I have. I don't. But what I'm saying is that it's kind of, I mean, it's just normal and it's working and everyone's clean and everyone's following the recovery.
Does it concern you at all that when the drug was opiates and its derivatives, and that was the primary drug, it was something everybody could relate to, the NA model seemed to work for it, but I just heard you describe a situation where the numbers of newcomers are smaller, and I heard that last week from Paul and Ron, where when they described the countdown, they were talking about a relatively small number of newcomers. And then when they got into the, you know, years, then the crowd was really standing up. And that, my ears perked up a little bit. I was going, is something changing in Iran where the newcomers aren't coming in droves like they did before? Is that cause for concern for you?
Not really, because we still get, newcomers. Maybe not as much. I mean, the numbers we were getting before was just something out of imagination. I mean, it was just extraordinary. Now this is ordinary. I mean, even right now, comparing the number of the newcomers we get to the other countries, I bet it's a whole lot more, you know. But it is a concern for me, because we cannot help addicts as much as we like to. Because I mean, they come in and addiction is getting worse in Iran. That, I mean, NA is getting bigger, but that doesn't mean addiction is going away in Iran. I mean, it's just awful. As long as now they're saying, I mean, before they wouldn't let addicts hang out because they were saying it's a crime and they would take him in and they would put him away in jail. Right now they don't do it, firstly because they say it's not a crime, secondly, because they don't have enough space to take him in. They don't have enough jails. So now there are huge places in parks and things beside the auto highways, you know, where you can see hundreds and hundreds of addicts just using right in front of everybody in daylight. Like the kids are walking by and the women are walking by, the housewives, and they're just all surprised and freaked out, you know, seeing this guy, I don't know, having a shot or things like that. So I'm saying the addiction is getting worse. And I really wish that we could do something, that we could get these guys into the program too. They still come in. The numbers are big too, but it's not as much as it used to be. I think one of the reasons is the industrial drugs, you know, the crack.
You call them industrial drugs. You mean the kind of side effect, like crack cocaine? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, the cracks that they're making in the laboratories and things like that.
Relapse. You know, is it a big problem there?
No, the number of relapses, that's one of the reasons that we kept growing. I mean, the number of the relapses in the program was very, very low. You hardly see anyone. I mean, I know some people who has relapsed, but the numbers comparing to other places is very low.
Well, how about the ratio of men to women? Where are you at with that now?
I don't know. It's just a wild guess, but I'm saying maybe 5% to 95.
5 to 95. So,
but the reason is that for a woman, the stigma of addiction, especially if they're not in a big city like Tehran or Shiraz and small cities, and it's very bad. So they have a hard time.
How many women would you say there are clean in Iran?
I'm saying maybe 10,000.
10,000. Okay. I think that was the number I thought I heard somebody say, which is a huge number.
Yes.
Yeah. And is that now, if you went with your 5 to 95% thing, now you're saying that there are a couple hundred thousand. So that's about, that squares with what you said earlier, maybe a couple hundred thousand members.
Yeah. Well, I think, we are more than 200,000, maybe 300,000, but the number of the women, I don't think, is more than 10,000. So maybe even it's less than 5%.
Mm-hmm. Okay. AA in Iran. What do you know about AA in Iran?
I know AA, you know, very well, because we are the one who started it. 18 years ago, 17 years ago, when I was just about a year clean, there was this guy who from USA who was telling us, you know, the big book from AA is very good, you should read it, you know. And so we didn't want to take the AA book inside the NA meeting because we knew that's violating the traditions. So we said, well, what the hell, let's start the AA meeting. So we started the AA meeting. So we had it for a while, but it didn't really grow. And then after a while, Allah was dispersed because, you know, we finished reading and sharing experience about the big book, but I personally couldn't identify with it. I never, drugs didn't ever let me have the chance to run into trouble with alcohol. You know, I never would spend my money on alcohol. If I have a dollar, I'll say, okay, I'll keep it and add another dollar to it and go and buy a bag of heroin. Why should I spend it on beer? So I never had any problem with it. So I couldn't identify with it personally. And that happened to a lot of the members who started it. So after a while, it died out. But now, it's several years that we have AA. But unfortunately, you don't get any real alcoholics. They are mostly NA members. Some, I don't know, that might be me judging. But I think NA members with resentment from the service structure in NA or from the NA meetings, they go to AA. They're not real alcoholics. So when you go to their meeting, they still share about drugs, recovery from drugs. I only know maybe two or three real alcoholics in Iran. But they have translated some literature, and they have the meetings. They're okay. They're not big, but they're okay.
So I remember just sort of almost comically, I heard somebody, and maybe it was you, somebody early on was saying that, you know, somebody would say, in Iran, have you ever heard of AA? And nobody's ever heard of it. And so somebody would say, well, it's kind of like NA. Oh, okay, now we understand.
Yeah. 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 In Iran, NA is the big time. I mean, it's the other way around from USA. I mean, in USA, AA started and NA came out of it. But in Iran, we started NA, then AA came on. Now we have OA, now we have nicotine anonymous, now we have... Sex addicts anonymous. So there are a lot of other fellowships pops up. NA is the mother of the whole team.
You said to me one time, and I know I've brought it up to you before, but it was when we were in Bahrain, that time, and we were trying to understand kind of how a fellowship develops. And I was trying to ask you questions that might help me understand what happened in Iran. And you talked about this sort of generational view, founders, and then the backlash against founders, and then the third generation. Do you remember what you were talking about there?
Yeah, right. What I said was that we had these members coming in from other countries, from USA and Canada, and they got involved in trying to prove that they're the one who started NA in Iran. And this fight between them got so bad that they split the fellowship into two for a while. And then the second generation was the members, which now are 20 or close to 20 years clean. They came in, but they were not willing. I don't know why, but they were not willing to do any services. And maybe I think because they took sides with the first generation. But they're still on the same after 20 years. So the third generation came, which were the guys from 16 years to 19, 18 and a half years clean now. And they were the third generation. And we were the one who started the services structure. And once the services structure started, these fights over the who was the one who started NA in Iran was being carried into the services structure. So at some point, me, Mahmoud, and a couple of other guys decided that, okay, we should ask them just to take the fights outside the services structure. Maybe it's this idea for them not to do any services anymore and resign from the service positions.
And so, they did.
And they did. But they thought we won't survive. I could see it in the eyes. They said, okay, we resign and see what you do. But we just get the vibration from them. And I could read it in the eyes that they thought, okay, we go, but NA is going to die in Iran. You guys won't survive. But that's not what happened. We started getting better. We didn't have anything to fight for, so we could spend our energy on something positive.
Yes. Yeah, you didn't have the baggage.
Yes.
I think what I find so compelling about that is there's kind of a macro view of that in NA as a whole, where you can look back to those people who were around before the basic text, who rallied and got the basic text written, that sort of generation that's now 30 some years clean. And there are factions within that generation of NA who still are doing the battles, some of the battles that came up back then, and they're still entrenched in the battles. And I'm waiting for that generation to come along to say to my generation, okay, you guys just step aside. We really don't need your battles anymore. We need to, we have a vision, and, we're there, I suppose, but in a way, the NA as a whole is still somewhat polluted by that very same kind of energy that you were just describing. It seems like it has its eye off the ball, to have your eye on the ball to me is like, how can we band together in unity to make this available to the next? And, we are doing that. But
exactly.
But we're doing that with such divisions that are painful. It's hard.
I think the internet has a way of amplifying these schisms within the fellowship. And the several that I'm thinking of really seem to have no great impact beyond the internet. I don't see it affecting NA anywhere in terms of events that draw us together, conventions, conferences, and the direction of the fellowship.
Yeah.
So I think some of us just like to fight. We have it in Iran too. It does affect the unity.
All right. Well, is there anything else that you want to say about the Iranian Fellowship?
Well, no, really, as that there was not the turning point that it happened in one night. It happened in 2-3 years. It took a lot of work. everyone is coming to it. There's a lot of people trying to take credit for it. But it's not like that. I mean, it was a group work. It wasn't me alone. It wasn't Mahmoud alone. It was none of us. It was a group work. And even those guys that I said that brought the NA to Iran and they're fighting and we asked them to resign, they had a great role. I mean, this one guy, at least, who was my sponsor, he did a lot. He taught a lot to us. I mean, we didn't know what the steps were. He worked the steps with us. You know, he has a good knowledge. So I wasn't trying to discredit anyone. I was just trying to give you some pictures of what happened.
So did we find the silver bullet? I think we did. I may have been looking right past it, though, for something unfamiliar. Maybe the silver bullet was too obvious. Siamak spoke of a kind of reverence and enthusiasm for the fundamental principles of NA and an activist, community-wide approach to service, holding those principles close. He spoke of the 12 steps being at the heart of sponsorship in the lives of all members. When he spoke of getting his hands on the first service literature and getting overwhelmed by emotion reading it, and then translating it for others, I remembered my own excitement the first time some of us in early recovery first got our hands on one of the early service manuals. We were energized by it, and we renamed things and tried things we hadn't tried before. It unleashed among us a vision and a creativity, and our fellowship blossomed. In Iran, this happened at a time and in a place where there were a million or more addicts suffering and yearning for freedom, and in a culture where a spiritual approach such as the 12 steps could be easily embraced. So there, maybe, is that perfect storm I was looking for. Once the NA subculture began to form, people jumped in the lifeboat and picked up a paddle. So maybe the conditions were such that the explosion of recovery and service was unprecedented, but the methods and the principles were not. Talk to anyone who will listen, who has contact with addicts, and give them clear information about NA. The excitement and camaraderie of this is not new. Bring the message into hospitals and institutions. Make sure all our efforts come clearly from the heart of our primary purpose. This silver bullet is known all over the world. Their excitement and their dedication to these tried and true methods does give us something to be inspired by. We'll finish out our interview with Siamak now, as Dave moves the discussion to a more personal note.
Well, it's clear to me that you were there at the very beginnings of something that's grown quite extraordinary. How do you feel about it?
Well, I'm happy and I'm proud because I had my own part in it. You know, I did a lot of work in translation of the literature in Iran. I don't know. I mean, now looking back, maybe that was the only opportunity that I had to become clean and stay clean and experience a new life. So I'm proud and I'm happy and thankful. Yeah. That's one of the biggest experiences, or a life-turning experience in my life, I mean. Because I was in a mess when I joined NA. Doctors would tell me that I would probably die if I carried on for like this for a couple more months, because I was really sick, and so it's just grateful.
Yeah, when I look at this screen and the three individuals I see there, including myself, I know enough about all of us that we came into NA when it was very small in our given areas. And then it seemed to call for a kind of commitment to establish the fellowship and to try to make it grow that really sustained, I would guess, each of us in our individual recoveries.
Yes, exactly. And, it was, for me, it was like I would get hold of this piece of literature in English and I would read it. And I was so overwhelmed with it, but a lot of things that I didn't know if I'm doing right or wrong, and I would read it there, and it was just, it was a great feeling. So I wanted to just explain everything for everyone else. So for a while, I used to just read it and translate it orally for the members who didn't understand. Then I said, what the hell, I should start writing it,
I'm sure anyone who knows you will know what I'm observing in talking to you and seeing you is that there's a great joy about recovery on your face. And I'm gathering that you really derive a great deal of joy out of living the recovery life.
Oh, yes. As I said, I mean, I didn't have any hope myself to carry on living. And so I'm living another extra 18 years now since I've joined NA. And I didn't have anything, no money, no family, nothing. So now, you know, I have a family, I have a life, I have a son, which I love. And it's all through recovery. I mean, it wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for NA. Because, you know, as I said, I had at least used 21 years. I never thought I had a chance. Stand a chance to live a clean life and live a different life. So, yeah, I'm enjoying it right now because I still think it's a miracle.
Yeah, no, it's a. I think the word is gratified. I feel gratified that
yes,
knowing that, you know, I was there, and maybe in some sense I was an instrument.
Yes,
of a higher power of the energy that was moving. At the time, and you know, Dave mentioned it before. Probably all three of us share that experience, just having been, you know, longtime members in our own communities. And maybe the big difference is we never saw anything quite like you saw in terms of what blossomed and flowered. Except maybe the worldwide fellowship, but the, you know, that's a little bit beyond one's own influence. But in your case, to have the fellowship blossom that way, like. Bang into this. It just must have been really gratifying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. I mean, I'm grateful that God chose me as an instrument.